years. I work for a company that specialises in underwater acoustics, but I won't bore you with that now. Hopefully you've had a chance to read through Mark 14 and 15 and Isaiah 53, because that's kind of what we're looking at. Looking at the Passion of Christ and Jesus' death, focusing on Jesus' death, and then we'll share communion together and briefly look at Mark 16. I just want to let you know kind of the place that I'm in right now. So I've actually prepared this talk before coming here, but on arriving here, I've lost a close friend, someone who I've had the privilege of walking with for 3 years, a privilege of just seeing God at work in him, seeing him just grow in his trust of God and seeing him grasp this. Emotionally I'm kind of on a knife edge, so if I fall apart, don't worry, but it might happen. It's also a privilege to be able to share on this, because this is what kind of gives us hope. This is why we can rejoice that James is in heaven now. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for your love. Thank you for how you've shown it to us. Lord, I pray that you would just speak to us now. Give us a deeper, greater, wider sense of how vast your love truly is. How much you love each one of us here. And Lord, would you use me in my weakness? In Jesus' name. So I guess we kind of start with what James mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15, 3, which says, "For what I received, I passed on to you of first importance, that Christ died for sins according to the Scriptures." And that's kind of what we're focusing on. But I wonder, how far have you gone to prove your love to someone? What's the furthest length that you've kind of gone to show someone how much you love them? What's the biggest thing that you've done to show that you love your best friend? To show that you love your boyfriend or girlfriend? To show that you love your husband or wife? To show that you love your family? I wonder how far would you be willing to go? I've got a funny story of, maybe it's not that funny, but I'm waiting to see. Before Kate and I started dating, I kind of knew that, something going on, I clearly liked her, and just, I wanted to find out how much she liked me, or if she did or not. So I devised this amazing plan. I thought, if she really liked me, I could probably get her to do anything I want. So I decided the best thing to do was to get her to sing a song, film herself, and put it on YouTube. And if you know Kate, she will not sing, she sings very quietly, so you can't hear her. She would not do that. So to film myself and put it on YouTube is the most ridiculous thing ever. But she did it.
Is it still there?
No, she took it down. However,
you have a copy?
I think Luke has it. However, in order to get her to do that, I had to do it myself first. And I think she chose the song, which was a Welsh song, in Welsh. apparently about goats or something. But yeah, the point is, I had to be willing to take that first step. I had to be willing to initiate. And in 1 John 4:19, it says, "We love because he first loved us." So why did God send his son to die for us on the cross? You know, we know John 3:16 well, don't we? "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son." But I wonder if sometimes we get bored of the cross. It's like, oh yeah, God sent his son to die for us. Yeah, so why did God send his son to die for us? Does anyone know Romans 5:8? Luke?
"But God demonstrates his love for us." God demonstrates his own love for us in this while we were still sinners, Christ died for us.
Yeah, but God demonstrates his love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And in 1 Peter 3:18, it says, "For Christ died for sins." No, yeah, Luke.
"For Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He has touched death in the body, but made life in the spirit."
Yeah. To bring you to God. So, kind of the aim of my talk is to draw you in to the Passion, to Christ, the events leading up to Jesus' death on the cross. And yeah, because this isn't just Jesus' story, but it's our story. And when we choose to accept Christ, and this becomes a key part of who we are. And so I'm going to start just going to kind of rush through touching on the various things that Jesus went through and had to endure. And then we're going to share communion. And then we'll briefly look at Mark 16. So at the beginning of Mark 14, or a little bit on, we see there's the Last Supper. And this is a time when all the men in Israel are coming to Jerusalem, because the law stipulates that they all need to come to Jerusalem to share in the Passover meal, and to remember that time when God sent his Spirit God sent his Spirit over Egypt and to sacrifice the firstborn of every family. And he told the Israelites to paint blood on the doorframes of the Israelites, so that they would pass over and that the lamb that was sacrificed would be the sacrifice instead of the firstborn of these families, whereas the rest of the people in Egypt lost their firstborn. And so the context in which Jesus says, this is my body broken for you, this is my blood poured out for you, is extremely poignant. Because here's a group of men who have grown up coming to a Passover meal, sharing in Passover meal. And they know the words that have been said, the same words that are kind of always said. And yet there's Jesus holding the bread and the wine in the context of the Passover lamb, saying, this is my body broken for you. This is my blood poured out for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And how well the disciples kind of grasped that, I have no idea, but clearly they would have noticed he's saying something different. What does this mean? So next we see that Jesus has to endure great spiritual battle in order to prove his love for us. And we see the intimacy of Jesus' relationship with the Father as he struggles with the events that are to unfold. And we see in chapter 14, verses 33 and 34, that he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. And he even says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Do you notice the language used here? Distressed, troubled. And he even says to his closest three friends, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. He says, overwhelmed. This is Jesus speaking here. He's so overwhelmed, he cries out and pleads with the Father that if it is possible, that the hour might pass from him. He says, Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Just imagine the weight of the struggle and temptation that Jesus must have been facing. His request doesn't come out of wanting to go another way than that of his Father's will, but it's more that he is expressing his brutal honesty. And it's as if he's saying, is there no other way, God? No other way than to face severe humiliation and pain, suffering, and horrific, slow, excruciating death on a Roman cross. But he goes on to say, yet not what I will, but what you will. It's just incredible, isn't it? Yet not what I will, but what you will. And Jesus submits to his Father's will because he knows the great blessing that it will bring. The hope that it will bring. A blessing that outweighs the horror of the struggle and physical suffering that awaits him, and the current emotional and spiritual battle that he's contending in this moment. Next we see Jesus had to be betrayed to prove his love for you. Jesus had to be betrayed to prove his love for you. And in verse 42, it clearly shows that Jesus knows exactly what's about to happen. He says, rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. Just imagine how Jesus felt as he saw Judas coming towards him, approaching him as a disciple approaches his master, exclaiming, Rabbi, and greeting him with a kiss, as expected from a disciple or follower of a rabbi. a greeting from someone who seeks to listen to his teacher, to learn from him, to imitate him, to follow him, and to help him. This is someone who Jesus has spent much of his ministry with, who he trusted and entrusted responsibility to, and who he loved and taught. Think of how wretched his heart was, how torn, knowing that Judas came to betray him. Jesus had to be arrested to prove his love for you. So with Judas is a crowd of armed swords and clubs. And these aren't Roman soldiers who have no interest in Jesus at the moment, but temple police sent by the chief priests, teachers of the law and elders. And do you see Jesus' response? It's sarcasm. He appears pretty calm and in control when he says, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to catch me?" Then he goes on to say, "Every day I was right there. You could have just grabbed me at any point. Yet you didn't. And now you come to me with weapons. Why?" It's almost like he throws it back to them and says, "You know I'm a threat to you, but you're so concerned with your appearance and power that you've missed the very thing that you've been waiting for, a Messiah." And maybe I'm reading a bit too much into this, but nevertheless, you can't fail to notice the direct comment Jesus makes in response to his arrest. And then he remarks, almost as an afterthought, "But the scriptures must be fulfilled." And if you look at Isaiah 53, you can see that much of that is fulfilled. Next, Jesus was abandoned in order to prove his love for you. Jesus was abandoned in order to prove his love for you. In verse 50, chapter 14 says, "Then everyone deserted him and fled." And again, we see that in Zechariah 13, verse 7, which says, "I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will scatter," that this is fulfilled completely. So he's abandoned by his closest friends, but not just his closest friends, it says that everyone deserted him. He's abandoned by everyone. Can you really imagine being abandoned by everyone you've ever known? Like, even just your closest friends. We've all probably had some experience of rejection, or felt like we've been abandoned, or let down. And maybe for some here, that's caused some deep hurt. Personally, the worst experience of abandonment, if I can even call it that, is being dumped by a girl when I was 16. But can you imagine if you've just been arrested for something that you didn't do, and the people that could prove that you were completely innocent are your closest friends, yet instead of standing by you, they run away, leaving you by yourself? Do you remember that feeling of abandonment, just of rejection? Well, think how much worse it would have been for Jesus. Not just betrayed by one of his disciples, but abandoned by those closest to him. Abandoned by everyone. Moving on, you see, Jesus was unjustly tried in order to prove his love to you. Jesus was unjustly tried in order to prove his love for you. So next they take Jesus to the high priest. And we see that all the chief priests, elders, and teachers of the law together. And it seems as if they're there to conspire. It's like they're saying to one another, what's our game plan? How are we going to play this one? How are we going to trap him? And did you notice in verse 55, they've actually already decided the punishment. It says, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but isn't the whole purpose of a court to be impartial? To judge the case that is brought before it without bias or prejudice, in the interest of fairness and justice? Most certainly, its purpose is to guard against injustice and false condemnation. It turns out that there was a great deal of evidence, but none of it matched up. None of their statements agreed. They couldn't find the evidence that would fit the already chosen punishment. Some fair trial, eh? The best that they could do is twist Jesus' words. They claimed he said, I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days we'll build another. Except we know that Jesus actually said, destroy this temple, referring to his body, and I will raise it in 3 days. From John 2:19. No mention of a man-made temple. So it's rather ironic, really, isn't it? Because they're using his own prediction of his own death and twisting it in the hope that that might fit the evidence against Jesus that they were looking for to fit the already chosen punishment. Definitely fair. And what's Jesus' response to this? Silence. Isaiah 53:7. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Next, Jesus was condemned in order to prove his love for you. So we've reached the point in the trial when we, the reader, are left thinking, how much further can this go? And then comes the question directed at Jesus. Are you the Christ, Son of the Blessed One, the Son of God? Finally, a legitimate question. I am, says Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, and coming on clouds of heaven. You can just hear the authority of the might, of the authority and serenity with which Jesus speaks to them as he quotes the prophecy in Daniel concerning himself. The problem is, the chief priest didn't ask the question for the sake of determining the truth, but it was the only way to get the evidence or confession to fit the already chosen punishment. Never mind the fact that what Jesus said was the truth. No, in fact, the chief priest was so one-track minded, so closed in his thinking, that he goes on to accuse Jesus. Let's remember, Jesus is God incarnate, the God who created and sustains the universe. He goes on to accuse him of blasphemy. And then condemns him worthy of death. The Sanhedrin condemned God worthy of death. Next, Jesus was handed over to be crucified to prove his love for you. Following the so-called trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin, the chief priests, elders, teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin decide to bow on Jesus and turn him over to Pilate, as ultimately they have no power to hand out capital punishment. He would have to be sentenced by a Roman leader, and it's at this point that upsteps to the scene Pilate. The chief priests turn Jesus over to Pilate, along with a long list of colourful accusations. Of course, blasphemy counts for nothing under the Roman rule, so the accusations are likely to consist of encouragement of tax evasion, treason, claiming to be a king, the king of the Jews, an insurrection, spreading panic, causing riots out in the countryside. Again, what is Jesus' response to these accusations? Silence. He made no reply. Isaiah 53:7 rings through. Yet he did not open his mouth. As a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. And the culmination of this trial ends with Pilate's concern for his popularity, causing him to reject the false accusations and the wealth of poor evidence against Jesus in favour of pleasing the ever-increasing vocal crowd who shall crucify him. Crucify him. Next, Jesus was flogged, mocked, spat on, and beaten in order to prove his love for you. It says, he had Jesus flogged and handed over to be crucified. Now, probably think Mark is very brief and to the point in his account. And much of that is likely to be due to the fact that the readers in Rome that the account was originally written to would have known the horrors of a flogging under Roman rule. And the same can definitely be said of crucifixion, something that wouldn't have been mentioned in social circles. Let me just tell you a little bit about a Roman flogging. It consisted of a leather scourge, which is a whip with several strands, and each of the strands is embedded with pieces of metal or bone. Whereas the beatings administered by the synagogues consisted of a tighter whip, not weighed down with metal or bone fragments. And also, in the synagogue, the number of lashes would be reduced depending on the condition of the offender, with the maximum being 40 lashes. However, the Jews would always stop at 39 in case they miscounted for fear of breaking the law. And within the synagogue, they always took into account the condition of the offender. So if they couldn't have withstand 40 lashes, then they would have reduced it so that they would still be alive, so they would still be able to live. However, a Roman flogging was nothing short of being brutally painful, void of even a drop of compassion. humiliating public spectacle. Sometimes it could be imposed as a penalty itself, but often it was just used as a means of making the degrading, humiliation more severe for the crucifixion. No limit is prescribed, and contemporary history tells us it was common for men to collapse and die from the effects of a flogging alone, never even surviving to the cross. Bruises weren't the concern here. No. Lacerations of the skin, puncturing, cutting and ripping. A church historian wrote this about an account of a flogging. For they say that bystanders were struck with amazement when they saw them lacerated with scourges, even to the innermost veins and arteries, so that the hidden inward parts of the body, both their bowels and their members, were exposed to view. We've all experienced pain in varying degrees. But who would willingly choose to endure the horrific physical pain of a Roman flogging in order to demonstrate his love? Not only is Jesus tortured and mocked, but mocked. Verses 17 and 18 of chapter 15. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted a crown of thorns and set it on him, and began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spat on him. Falling to their knees, they paid homage to him. And Isaiah 53 verse 4 says, "Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted." Next, Jesus was crucified. He was nailed to a Roman cross because he loves you, in order to demonstrate his love for you. Then they led him out to be crucified. He's forced to carry the cross, and we know from the other gospel accounts that he's too weak to carry it all the way following the flogging. And at the place called Golgotha, they offer him mixed wine mixed with myrrh to lessen the pain. But he refuses. He refuses to make the experience any easier or less painful, in order that he might bear the full weight of the punishment of the world's sins on himself. And then they crucified him. Again, Mark is very brief, isn't he? But let me just illustrate that. Heavy nails driven through the hands and feet of Jesus. Isaiah 53:5. "But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities." Nailed to the cross, they then raise him up in all humiliation. There he is for all to see, the flogged, beaten, spat on, mocked and crucified Jesus. God on a cross, left to die a slow and excruciatingly painful death. If you haven't already read the medical depiction of crucifixion, a crucifixion by death, on the final page of the booklets, then do take a look later. But let me warn you, it's not comfortable reading. And what makes it less even less comfortable is knowing that Jesus chose to die this way because he loves you, me, because he loves us. Jesus chose to be obedient to the Father, obedient even to death, death on the cross. And before he breathes his last on the cross, despite all that he's endured, the spiritual suffering, the physical agony, and the emotional pain, yet there were still people standing there, hurling insults at him. So, you are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days? Come down from the cross and save yourself. He saved others, but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross, that we may see and believe. Do you hear the temptation? End it now, save yourself. Make use of the access you have to divine power. Yet Jesus is resolute. He's already fought the battle. Remember in the Garden of Gethsemane? Yet not what I will, but what you will. It's just incredible, isn't it? A love that drives Jesus to the point of separation from the Father. My God, why have you forsaken me? He cries. Jesus faces separation from the Father in order that we might be able to have a relationship with him. I'm not going to pretend to know how that works. God the Son separated from God the Father. 2/3 of the Trinity, the triune God. But regardless of this mystery, what we can say is that Jesus is facing nothing short of hell. Separation from God. Separation from his Father. Verse 37 to 39. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two, from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry, he saw how he died. And he said, surely this man was the Son of God. Surely this man was the Son of God. I just want to spend a few moments for you just to reflect, just to maybe just close your eyes. And I'm just going to just briefly run through just some of the words that some of the things that Jesus endured. And then we're going to share communion together. And just be considering, what does Jesus' crucifixion and death mean to you? Jesus was humiliated. Jesus was betrayed. Jesus was arrested. He was wrongly accused, adjudged to have blasphemed. Jesus was condemned worthy of death. He was spat on, blindfolded, and then struck with the fists of evil men. He was taken and beaten, bound and led away. He was called to be crucified by the crowd. Jesus was innocent. Jesus was flogged and then handed over to be crucified. Like a lamb to the slaughter. At the place of Golgotha, he was brutally crucified. Tempted on the cross. Temptation that goes beyond what anyone has ever been tempted. He was heaped with insults. Jesus faces separation from his Father. On the cross, he breathed his last.
He is risen. He's risen.
Amen.
He's risen. Let's do that properly. He is risen.
He is risen indeed.
He is risen.
He is risen indeed.
It's good news. Christ died for us. But that's not the end. He is risen. He rose again, conquering death. He gives us hope. Hope for now. Hope for what's to come. And because of what he's done, we can rejoice. And we can rejoice that our dear friend James is with God. Let me just finish with a verse from In Christ Alone. It's then bursting forth in glorious day. Up from the grave he rose again, and as he stands in victory, since curse has lost its grip on me, for I am his and he is mine, bought with the precious blood of Christ. Let me just leave you with these questions. What is your response the death and resurrection of Jesus? What is your response to the death and resurrection of Jesus? And this is kind of the same question. What is your response to the demonstration of God's love for you? How do you respond to the God's demonstration of his love for you? Maybe we can just have a chance to share in our discussion groups the times when you've realized, when you've kind of grasped hold of God's love for you and what he did on the cross. Surely this man was the Son of God. Surely this man was the Son of God.